Hosted by the Creative Writing Program, the lecture is part of a series of high-profile poetry readings celebrating the legacy of the historic Boston University class in which Robert Lowell once taught poets Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, and George Starbuck. Introducing Miss Boland tonight is former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky. Professor Pinsky.
Van Boland is a marvel. She has a career, any part of which would make people use the word greatness. By the parts, I mean the things she does, but also the different stages of it. Her most recent book, her ninth, is called Against Love Poetry. She did a collected poems once that was called Outside History. The being against love poetry is the deepest form of rebellion, the civilized form of rebellion, that is, in fact, against stereotypes and cliches. She's written memorable poems about women and being a woman that decline a whole host of cliches on that subject. The most recent book ends with a poem that goes beyond the facile idea that Ireland is the country where everyone is potentially an Orpheus, where it's all poetic. Our tradition in introductions here is not to give a list of honors and awards. She has many of them. She is now the director of the writing program, the Stegner Fellows program at Stanford. She is a hero and a model to other poets, young and her contemporaries, because of the distinction of her work, the variety of her work, that you always knew, you always know there will be something new. It will break new territory, and it'll keep up the same standards of art and excellence. It is truly an honor to introduce Van Boland.
I first of all want to say, you know, that I'm truly honored to be introduced by Robert in that way and for his generosity. I'm just going to read some things and explain how I wrote them. And the first is just a very brief prose piece from a book I wrote called Object Lessons. And it's very short and it's self-explanatory. In the early days of October in the year 1909, a woman entered a Dublin hospital near the centre of the city. The building is still there. If you approach from the south with the Dublin hills behind you and you look down a tunnel of grace made by the houses of Fitzwilliam and Marion Squares, your view will end abruptly in this. The National Maternity Hospital, red brick and out of character, blocking the distance. The rooms inside are functional and light eating, and they show no evidence of that zest for air and proportion, which was once the mask of our Augustan oppressor. October is a beautiful month in the city of Dublin. If you go round and you go back towards the hills away from the hospital, the roads are narrow and gracious above the canal. The woman who entered the hospital might have passed them as she made her way to it. If, for instance, she drove around Stephen's Green, having arrived on the late morning train from Drogheda, she may also have noticed a trick of light peculiar to that time of year. In the dark corridor of Lower Leeson Street, sunlight cuts the houses in half, and halfway up the brick, the reflection of the houses opposite builds another street, chimneys, roofs, and gutters made of unglittering shadow. And she mightn't have come that way. She might have travelled down the unglamorous back streets that lead more directly to the hospital. Fenian Street and Hogan Place and past the mills, past the Dodder River on its way to the Liffey, and up the slight gradient which would still in that year be cobbled. The pre-winter chill which can be felt on some October mornings could have struck extra music out of the horse's hooves. It isn't a long drive. But whatever she saw that morning is lost. Whatever that journey yielded, the child with a hoop who never existed, the woman with a red hat I am now inventing, They were her last glimpses of the outside world. And this is the way we make the past, and this is the way I will make it here. Listening for hooves, glimpsing the red hat which was never there in the first place, giving eyesight and evidence to a woman I never knew and cannot now recover. And for all our violations, the past waits for us. The road from the train to the hospital opens out over and over again, vacant and glittering, offering shadows and hats and hoops. Again and again, I visit it and reinvent it. But the woman who actually traveled it had no such freedom. Hers was a real journey, and she didn't come back. On October the 10th, she died in the National Maternity Hospital. She was 31 years of age, and she was my grandmother. Now, the reason I pick out that very short piece is because one of the things that, you know, I don't want to say tormented me, but certainly troubled me when I was young and trying to find my path, was to live in a small country which has an extraordinarily powerful and compelling and self-invented history, the history of Ireland, of heroism. Somewhere I knew that there was a big rift between the past and history, but I couldn't prove it. And, you know, I knew that if I didn't find that rift, I would be really at risk as a writer. Because, you know, the idea, Napoleon once said, history is the agreed lie. He had reasons to say so, but nevertheless. And, you know, in Ireland, we had this heroic history. But one time I went down to a little famine museum in the middle of the country. The Irish famine was in 1847, and the poem which I'm about to read comes from that. And there is a letter from hell on the wall of the famine museum. It's a woman who'd taken ship for America, writing back to the middleman of the estate to ask him to get her children out of the workhouse where she left them. And you know that the children are dead when you read the letter, or it was written for her. But nobody reads that story into the story of heroes. And somehow that wide, broadening abyss between the past and history began to influence me more and more. And this is a poem which is directly about it. It's called That the Science of Cartography is Limited, and it is about the 1847 famine when the British relief committees came over to Ireland, very big potato famine, and the people had lost their strength. And the economists would not, on the laissez-faire economics of Britain, would not give them food unless they worked for it. But of course, they had no strength to work. But nevertheless, the relief committees assigned them roads to build. And when you look down in Ireland, in Mayo or Meath especially, you'll see these roads that give out in the woods and lead nowhere, where the people died making them. They never show up on any Irish map. That the science of cartography is limited, and not simply by the fact that this shading of forest cannot show the fragrance of balsam, the gloom of cypresses, is what I wish to prove. When you and I were first in love, we drove to the borders of Connacht and entered a wood there. Look down, you said. This was once a famine road. I looked down at ivy, and the scotch grass rough cast stone had disappeared into, as you told me, in the second winter of their ordeal. In 1847, when the crop had failed twice, relief committees gave the starving Irish such roads to build. Where they died, there the road ended and ends still. And when I take down the map of this island, it is never so. I can say, here is the masterful, the apt rendering of the spherical as flat, nor an ingenious design which persuades a curve into a plane, but to tell myself again that the line which says woodland and cries hunger and gives out among sweet pine and cypress and finds no horizon will not be there. I'm lucky enough to teach at Stanford, and one of my great good fortunes is to teach and to be with other poets. And I would certainly say that it was my second favorite job in the world. And my first favorite, I'll explain to you, was in 1994, the National Maternity Hospital, which is the hospital in James Joyce's Oxen of the Sun chapter in Ulysses, not a very flattering account of the hospital, but and is the big central hospital, had a centenary. And they asked me to be their poet in residence. And it was a very Irish job. It had no job description of any kind at all. And people would say to me, you know, what are you doing in the hospital? And, you know, are you with the new mothers and babies? And, of course, I never went near the new mothers and babies because, you know, my own children were born in the National Maternity Hospital, and just about the last thing I would have liked to have seen would have been the poet in residence. So, but I did. They did give me a room, and I did write this poem in that year. It's called The Pomegranate, and it's something that's everybody here will understand. It's having a child that turns into a teenager. Pomegranate. It's built out over the great legend, of course, of Ceres and Persephone. The child is taken to the underworld and the mother goes down to try to get her back. But the child could have come back. She only gets back for 6 months. Could have come back completely if she'd eaten nothing, but she eats pomegranate. The only legend I have ever loved is the story of a daughter lost in hell and found and rescued there. Love and blackmail are the gist of it. Ceres and Persephone, the names. And the best thing about the legend is I can enter it anywhere and have. As a child in exile in a city of fogs and strange consonants, I read it first, and at first I was an exiled child in the crackling dusk of the underworld, the stars blighted. Later, I walked out in a summer twilight searching for my daughter at bedtime. When she came running, I was ready to make any bargain to keep her. I carried her back past white beams and wasps and honey-scented buddleias, but I was Ceres then, and I knew winter was in store for every leaf on every tree on that road, was inescapable for each one we passed and for me. It is winter and the stars are hidden. I climb the stairs and stand where I can see my child asleep beside her teen magazines, her can of Coke, her plate of uncut fruit, the pomegranate. How did I forget it? She could have come home and been safe and ended the story and all our heartbroken searching, but she reached out a hand and plucked a pomegranate. She put out her hand and pulled down the French sound for apple and the noise of stone and the proof that even in the place of death at the heart of legend, in the midst of rocks full of unshed tears, ready to be diamonds by the time the story was told, a child can be hungry. I could warn her, there is still a chance. The rain is cold, the road is flint-colored. The suburb has cars and cable television. The veiled stars are above ground. It is another world. But what else can a mother give her daughter but such beautiful rifts in time? If I defer the grief, I will diminish the gift. The legend will be hers as well as mine. She will enter it as I have. She will wake up. She will hold the papery, flushed skin in her hand. And to her lips, I will say nothing. In Dublin, in the beginning of the 70s, Ireland, which had thought for a while that its differences would become its strengths, came to very dark times. Some of the poems which I wrote in the book called Against Love Poetry had some echo of that, but not enough. But this is a poem that I would perhaps once have written as a historical poem, but I wrote or wanted to write as a dark love poem. It's called Quarantine, and in a way it was the end of my troubled relation with that sense of the past and history. Quarantine refers to a very, very small event, which almost there is no note of, to show how fragile the past is and how much a place of whispers and sighs and lost shadows. There is a book called Mushkil Fin, which would once have been taught very widely in Ireland by Anpadhar Porrick O'Leary. He was a priest who wrote at the very beginning of the century about his experiences as a very young boy in the famine. And one of the things he notes in, I think, 3.5 sentences is there was a couple who went back on a bitter night and were found dead in the morning, and the man had held her feet against his chest as she died. They were both dead. And out of those 3.5 sentences comes that small gleam, which is just not enough, but at least is that shorthand of what people's lives were in those profound and terrible silences. This poem is called Quarantine. In the worst hour of the worst season of the worst year of a whole people, a man set out from the workhouse with his wife. He was walking, they were both walking north. She was sick with famine fever and could not keep up. He lifted her and put her on his back. He walked like that, west and west and north, until at nightfall, under freezing stars, they arrived. In the morning, they were both found dead, of cold, of hunger, of the toxins of a whole history. But her feet were held against his breastbone. The last heat of his flesh was his last gift to her. Let no love poem ever come to this threshold. There is no place here for the inexact praise of the easy graces and sensuality of the body. There is only time for this merciless inventory. Their death together in the winter of 1847. Also, what they suffered, how they lived, and what there is between a man and woman, and in which darkness it can best be proved. Because of the past and history, I had a huge fascination with the way people remember things. And perhaps the most interesting of all to me was the great hero of my life, really, my own mother, who was the fifth child of that woman who died in the National Maternity Hospital, came from a very hard-pressed background. And my mother had no interest of any kind in the past in any possible way. She never told any stories about it. She never referred to family. Her father drowned in the Bay of Biscay, and she was orphaned at her mother's birth. She didn't have an interest in it, and she had no sentiment about it. I used to say to her, you know, you must remember something. There were no photographs because the family was broken up. And when my own children were very small, I used to go down to her. She would live very near me, and we would talk in the evening. And I'd say, you have to remember something. You know, there must be something, you know. And one evening, you know, like a door that just sprang open, she told me a story. And it was so bizarre that I said to her, you know, about her family background, is that true? And she said, I don't know. And so I say that simply so that you know what this story is. This is the story. My grandmother came from a family of millers. This is again from Object Lessons. Sometime after the famine, they left their small fishing town of Milford in Donegal. Hard pressed as they were, they must still have missed the idiosyncrasy of their own place. The sight of Mulroy Bay in February light in the main street with its steep climb up the side of a hill. They moved east and south to the town of Dundalk. There the business failed. And they moved again to Leitrim, where my mother's grandfather was born. And it was to him that legend clung. And the way I build that legend now is the way I heard it from my mother, out of rumour and fossil fact and half-memories. He was a small, compact man, my mother's grandfather, compact and saturnine in the way of many Western Irish people. If he was anything like the West of Ireland people, he had eloquent and strained features and a fine profile and close-set, obstinate eyes. There was something strained and pinched about it all, which kept it well away from beauty. He grew up in Leitrim, and sometime in his early manhood, I have to imagine the early 1870s, he fell in love with a local girl. I know so little about her or about him that I have to become the fictional interventionist here and say that she was, of course, winning and expressive and utterly true to him, and that he loved her stubbornly. But there was an obstacle. She was a younger sister, and in the manner of the fables and, of course, of the Irish rural world, her older sister was plain and deserving and on no account to be slighted by having the younger girl marry first. And so it went around. The parents insisted he should offer his suit to the older girl. They might have offered him inducements, but I doubt it. The inducement could only have been local custom and iron decorum. There were no dowries. These were poor people, reduced in circumstance by a difficult century, utterly vulnerable to the sickness of a heifer or a farthing's change in the price of wheat. They would have brought to bear on him the influence of local opinion and approval. He must marry the older girl, and that was that. He was implacable. It would be the younger one, and that was all. The younger one retained her love for him and he for her, and finally, now the story quickens a bit and gets unsteady and fills with unknown passages of time and event, the impasse yielded and love triumphed and the wedding day was set. I have no document or certificate. I have my grandmother's marriage certificate, but not this one. In any case, the cold signatures of the witnesses and sacristan could do no justice to this. The wedding day came. It seems safe to imagine a small granite church in the middle of a townland and the weather more than likely grey and overcast. And perhaps the turnout a bit more than usual because of the notoriety of the whole thing. The struggle of wills and all the gossip and the curiosity incurred on that account. The bride came dressed in white and heavily veiled. The vows were taken and repeated and said by the bride and the groom. The priest pronounced them man and wife. And for a single moment, it must have seemed to him that some wound of ill luck and misadventure in his own life had undergone a miraculous healing. Then he lifted her veil. It was not the face he loved. Convention had prevailed. The family had smuggled in the older, plainer girl, and he was bound to her by iron convention and legality for the rest of his life. However, they had 13 children, so it didn't really work out as too much of a thing. But that idea of the, you know, what is fugitive and, you know, how a small country invents its stories. My mother, what interested me about my mother was not the story, which was powerful, but that she had no interest whatsoever in whether it was true. And I think that has some bearing. This is a poem for my mother who died some years ago. It's called An Elegy for My Mother, in which she scarcely appears. And it seemed to me the right title. You know, when I was a very small child, we lived in the city of Dublin till I was about five, and then we went to London. But, you know, it was the 40s in Dublin, and I have a very, very clear memory of the elements in a kitchen and the old clothes horse and the old brass fire dogs, the things my mother really loved. And suddenly they were gone, replaced incrementally or replaced suddenly. And it's that strange sense of the suddenly disappearing world, which is this poem. I knew we had to grieve for the animals a long time ago, weep for them, pity them. I knew it was our strange human duty to write their elegies after we arranged their demise. I was young then and able for the paradox. I am older now and ready with the question. What happened to them all? I mean to those old dumb implements which have no eyes to plead with us like theirs, no claim to make on us like theirs. I mean there was a singing kettle. I want to know why no one tagged its neck or ring the tin base of its extinct design, or crouched to hear its rising shriek in winter, or wrote it down with the birds in their blue sleeves of air, torn away with the trees that sheltered them. And there were brass fire dogs which lay out all evening on the grate and in the heat, thrown at them by the last of the peat fire. But no one noted down their history or put them in the old packs under slate-blue moonlight. There was a wooden clothes horse, absolutely steady, without sinews, with no mane and no meadows to canter in, carrying, instead of landlords or Irish monks, rinsed tea cloths, but still, I would have thought, worth adding to the catalogue of what we need, what we still need, as is my mother on this Dublin evening of fog crystals and frost, as she reaches out to test one corner of a cloth for dryness, as the pre-war Irish twilight closes in and down on the room, and the curtains are drawn. And here am I, not even born, and already a conservationist, with nothing to assist me but the last and most fabulous of beasts, language, language, which knows, as I do, that it's too late to record the loss of these things, but does so anyway and anxiously, in case it shares their fate. That comes from a new book, which is just about getting finished, and it's called Domestic Violence. And the reason I gave it that title is because of my sense of the injury that was done at some point in poetry to the power and the charge and the importance and humanity of interior spaces. They didn't have the transcendental power of the pastoral or the outdoors. They were just the places people lived, and they were often profound mirrors for what happened outside. This poem, which is the title poem, is called Domestic Violence. It looks back to the early 70s when Kevin and I were first married, and we lived in a suburb just about 4 miles outside of Dublin, and every day would come down as the situation in Ireland got more and more difficult and tainted to the reports of murder after murder. And somehow, you know, in that house, to argue that you could live your life exempt from that. Now that I look back, I am profoundly troubled by the idea that we can live exempt from what happens around us. And this poem for me was some kind of revisiting of that. And the idea of a young couple quarreling at night as if that isn't part of everything. Domestic violence. It was winter, lunar, wet. At dusk, pewter seedlings became moonlight orphans. Pleased to meet you, meet to please you, said the butcher's sign in the window in the village. Everything changed the year that we got married. And after that, we moved out to the suburbs. How young we were, how ignorant, how ready to think the only history was our own. And there was a couple who quarreled into the night, their voices high and sharp. Nothing is ever entirely right in the lives of those who love each other. And in that season, suddenly, our island broke out its old sores for all to see. We saw them too. We stood there wondering how the salt horizons and the Dublin hills, the rivers, Table Mountains, Viking marshes we thought we knew had been made to shiver into our ancient 12x15 television, which gave them back as gray and grayer tears and killings, 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 then moonlight-colored funerals. Nothing we said, not then, not later, fathomed what it is wrong in the lives of those who hate each other. And if the provenance of memory is only that, remember, not atone. And if I can be safe in the weak spring light in that kitchen, then why is there another kitchen, spring light always darkening in it, and a woman whispering to a man over and over, what else could we have done? We failed our moment, or our moment failed us. The times were grand in size, and we were small. Why do I write that when I don't believe it? We lived our lives, were happy, stayed as one. Children were born and raised here and are gone, including ours. As for that couple, did we ever find out who they were, and did we want to? I think we know. I think we always knew. So that sense of the interior space, you know, is in this other new poem. We now live in a city in Dublin, which of course is at the focal point of the new Europe. A huge amount of prosperity has come to Ireland, huge amount of erasure of the old Ireland for good and ill. And, you know, especially down where we are, we're about as far south in the city. If we went any further south, we'd be in Wicklow. And our house is there and has been for many years. And somehow this unreality of extraordinary new bridges and vistas and shopping centres is the, especially the new bridge they were making for a long time near us. It's called In Our Own Country. They are making a new Ireland at the end of our road. Under our very eyes, under the arc lamps, they aim and beam into distances where we once lived, into vistas we will never recognize. We are here to watch. We are looking for new knowledge. They have been working here in all weathers, tearing away the road to our village, bridge, path, hill, riverbed, all lost under an onslaught of steel. An old Europe has come to us as a stranger in our city, has forgotten its own music wars and treaties, is now a machine from the Netherlands or Belgium, dragging, tossing, breaking apart the clay in which our timid spring used to arrive with our daffodils in a single crooked row. Remember the emigrant boat? Remember the lost faces burned in the last glances, the air clearing away to nothing, nothing, nothing. Construction work is finished for the night. The barriers are pulled across the walkway. They hang a sign on them. It reads no entry. We pull our collars tightly round our necks, but the wind finds our throats anyway, predatory, wintry. We walk home. What we know is this, and this is all we know. We are now, and we will always be from now on. For all I know, we have always been exiles in our own country. You know, I judged a competition for the Irish Times once. The Irish Times ran, I was running the poetry side, and we gave it to a distinguished Irish poet. And the editor of the Irish Times was a very nice man called Conor Brady, and he came in to preside over the awards. And he said, the Irish Times is a very long association with Irish writing, And he said, you know, we in the Irish Times have definitively worked out what really makes Irish poetry Irish poetry. And he said, for what it's worth, here it is. He said, we've worked it out that whereas only 10% of the Irish people, you know, read poetry, 45% of them write it. And, and, you know, whenever I think of Ireland, I always think of that, and I always think it's true. You know, when I was a young poet in this country where 45% of the people did something or other, it did not seem very often hospitable to poetry. And it didn't seem to me easy to find your way, especially as a young woman there. I was in a fairly ferocious city in literary terms. And therefore, you know, when I came later, though I didn't have the numbers, to read about that workshop that was given by Robert Lowell and had Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton and George Starbuck in it, I was so moved and really idealized that because it seemed to me so much the opposite of the hand-to-mouth fray that we lived in. George Moore once said, you know, as an Irish writer, he said, all you need for a literary revival is six people in the same town who hate each other, you know, and it was frequently provided in the city. But that wasn't to say that there didn't come to me the news. And when I was a young woman beginning college, I began to hear the name of Sylvia Plath. And it would be later that I read about her life. But I began to hear the name. And this is, you know, on foot of the very touching and powerful description that Robert gave of that room where people cared about the art. Here is this fraction of memory of hearing her name. In that year came news of a woman's death. Sylvia Plath, an American poet, just into her 30s, had died in London. It was a year later again that I began to hear about her. She was only talked about in fragments in Dublin, as a wife and as a suicide, in the heartless asides which pass for neighborly gossip among young poets. Only a few of her later poems were in circulation. It would be another year or so again before Ariel came out, and many more before the strength of her voice arrived to disrupt the voyeurism about her death. I began to listen for her name. Information was scarce. It was rare, in any case, that she was spoken about kindly or completely. In such talk as there was about her work and her death, I began to notice the same fractures I was starting to find in attitudes around me to women and to poetry. In her case, they were much intensified. She was a woman here and a poet there, weak in this place, strong in that. One night, by chance, I heard the date of her death, February the 11th, 1963. I thought back. I had been 18 then, just 8 months out of school, living in a basement flat with my sister. The bedroom had backed onto a garden with a line of paving, which zigzagged by front trees and chicken wire to the Dodder River. It was the coldest winter on record since the freeze-up of 47. The granite windowsill smoked with ice. Milk froze on the doorstep. The 12 steps down to the front door were little rinks in the dark. Every night when we went to bed, our frosty breaths fogged the conversation while we lay under the covers watching the dish and curve of the electric fire, the two rods which burned dust and glowed. Every morning, the clothes on the washing line were splayed into a wild stiffness by frost. And she had died alone in that season. The more I heard, the more pity I felt for it, that single act of desolation. From now on, I would write at least partly in the shadow of that act, unsettled and loyal. Other poets, mostly men, moved easily among the models of a poet's life, picking and choosing. I chose this one, not to emulate, but to honor. Not simply for the beautiful, striving language of the poems when I came to read them, but because I could see increasingly the stresses and fractures between a poet's life and a woman's, and how alone at a heartbroken moment for one woman they had proved fatal. And that goes with a poem I wrote years later, when I think some of that had been more resolved in my mind. It's called The Rooms of Other Women Poets. And into this came many composites. Sylvia Plath, Elizabeth Bishop, very much, whose work I was reading at that time, a sense of grace about the places they had worked. I wonder about you, whether the blue abrasions of daylight falling as dusk across your page make you reach for the lamp. I sometimes think I see that gesture in the way you use language. And whether you think as I do that wild flowers dried and fired on the ironstone rim of the saucer underneath your cup are a sign of a savage old calligraphy, you will not have it. The chair you use, for instance, may be cane soaked and curled in spirals, painted white and eloquent, or iron mesh, and the table a horizon of its own on plain deal trestles, bearing up unmarked steel-cut foolscap, a whole choir of it. When you leave, I know you look at them, and you love their air of unaggressive silence as you close the door. The early summer, its covenant, its grace is everywhere. Even shadows have leaves. Somewhere you are writing or have written in a room you came to, as I come to this room with honeyed corners, the interior sunless, the windows shut but clear, so I can see the bay wind break, the laburnum hang fire, feel the ache of things ending and the jasmine darkening early. All my life, I would have liked to write a feminist poem. It's extremely difficult to write it. It's very hard to write an Irish nationalist poem. It's very hard. But this is the nearest I ever came to it, and I put it there because it has a story around it. This is a poem called Code. And it is an ode to Grace Murray Hopper. For those of you who do know and those of you who don't know, she is the maker of the computer compiler and the verifier of COBOL. And that is because in my next life, I'm going to be a programmer. My greatest, you know, aspiration, I have loved computers from the minute I saw them. And here was this wonderful American woman, I think with close association with the Navy, who did indeed verify COBOL, probably about 30 years older than me, made the compiler, sat there in New Hampshire making this language, and I could imagine her, and I make a reference to it, making it all on the eighth day of creation. And I have an enormous, enormous admiration for her. I wish I'd met her. And for me, this came, as I said, nearest to writing a feminist poem, and I wish I could read COBOL. That's the other one. Code. Poet to poet, I imagine you at the edge of language at the start of summer in Wolfborough, New Hampshire, writing code. You have no sense of time, no sense of minutes even. They cannot reach inside your world, your gray workstation, with when, yet, now, never, and once. You have missed the other seven, and this is the eighth day of creation. The peacock has been made, the river stocked, the rainbow has leaned down to clothe the trout, the earth has found its pole, the moon its tides. Atoms, energies have done their work, have made the world, have finished it, have rested, and we call this creation, and you missed it. The line of my horizon, solid blue, appears at last, 50 years away from your fastidious exact patience. The first sign that night will be day is a stir of leaves in this Dublin suburb, and air and invertebrates and birds, as the earth resorts again to its explanations, its shadows, its reflections, its words. And you are west of me and in the past. Dark falls, light is somewhere else. The fireflies come out above the lake, and you are compiling binaries and zeros. The given world is what you can translate, and you divide the lesser from the greater. Let there be language, even if we use it differently. I never made it timeless as you have. I never made it numerate as you did. And yet I use it here to imagine how at your desk in the twilight, legend, history, and myth, of course, are gathering in Wolfborough, New Hampshire, as if to a memory, as if to a source. Maker of the future, if the past is fading from our view, with the light outside your window, and the single file of elements and animals, and all the facts of origin and outcome, which will never find their way to you or shelter in your syntax. It makes no difference to us. We are still human. There is still light in my suburb, and you are in my mind, head bowed and old enough to be my mother, writing code before the daylight goes. And I am writing at a screen as blue as any hill, as any lake, composing this to show you how the world begins again, one word at a time, one woman to another. That is the side that probably is brighter. I want to read a poem, which is indeed is from my own mother, which is called Amber. And belongs again to my sense of how charged interiors are, that place where we live. My mother gave me a small piece of amber once. Amber holds all the beautiful plants and the past, and it seemed to me a perfect talisman for our friendship. It never mattered that there was once a vast grieving. Trees on their hillsides, in their groves weeping, a plastic gold dropping through seasons and centuries to the ground, until now. On this fine September afternoon from which you are absent, I am holding, as if my hand could store it, an ornament of amber you once gave me. Reason says this: the dead cannot see the living. The living will never see the dead again. The clear air we need to find each other in is gone forever. And yet this resin once collected seeds, leaves, and even small feathers as it fell and fell, which now in a sunny atmosphere seem as alive as they ever were, as though the past could be present and memory itself a Baltic honey. A chafing at the edges of the scene, a showing off of just how much can be kept safe inside a flawed translucence. I'm going to finish with a poem, which is a new poem, and which is deliberately left with an edge. It's called Letters to the Dead. And I don't think a country or a place should be left to go unreproached for its acts of inhumanity. It's a reference actually to the Old Kingdom, an archaeological find. At the gates of the tombs, they often found small cups that were inscribed. And they were inscribed as letters to those who were dead to ask their counsel, to ask their advice. Letters to the Dead. In the Old Kingdom, scholars found pottery written round and round with signs and marks, written in siltware on the rims of bowls and laid at the entrance of tombs, and red with the iron of one world and laid at the threshold of another. They did not mourn or grieve those signs or marks. They were intimate, imploring, local, desperate. They were called letters to the dead. Here at the threshold of an Irish spring, you can no longer see. Light is getting ready. Hawthorn bushes with their small ivory flowers will soon come alive in every wind, and every hillside will be a distant bride. If I could write it differently, the secret history of a place, as if it were a story of hidden water, known only through the strange acoustic of a stream underfoot in shallow grass, it would be this story. I wanted to bring you the gifts of the island, the hawthorn in the last week of April, the sight of the Liffey above Leek's Lip. The willows there could be girls, their hair still wet after a swim. Instead, I have brought you a question. How many daughters stood alone at a grave and thought this of their mother's lives? That they were young in a country that hated a woman's body, that they grew old in a country that hated a woman's body. They asked for the counsel of the dead. They asked for the power of the dead. These are my letters to the dead. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Robert Lowell Memorial Lecture Series featuring the award-winning poet Evan Bolin. Hosted by the Creative Writing Program, the lecture was part of a series of high-profile poetry readings celebrating the legacy of the historic Boston University class in which Robert Lowell once taught poets Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, and George Starbuck. We began with an introduction by former U.S. Poet Laureate Professor Robert Pinsky. For a CD or a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skog, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Coselli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.